I'm Matt Bush with BPR News. I'm speaking with Dan Pierce. He's an author and a professor at UNC Asheville. Dan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Matt.
You'll be speaking Saturday at Ollie at UNC Asheville about your latest book, which talks about a community in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park that is no longer there. So tell us, what's the name of the community and what was it before the park was created?
Well, the community is Hazel Creek, and which is really, I guess, a watershed, basically, of the one of the largest creeks in the Great Smoky Mountains, which flows into now Fontana Lake, used to be, which is the Little Tennessee River. It was a fairly thriving, kind of on and off, a fairly thriving community in the early years of the 20th century. And then, of course, was when the Fontana Dam was built, people were forced to move, and then their land was condemned, and then that land was turned over to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which it is part of today.
To refresh people on this, how many communities were there in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park before it was created? Because there are quite a few, and some of the attractions of the park are going on these trails to find what's left of some of these places, like, you know, Cataloochee, for example.
Yeah, an exact count would take me a little while. And, of course, you know, there are communities and their communities. There were some, you know, pretty large thriving places like Cataloochee and probably the best known, which is Cades Cove in Tennessee. But there are also the Sugar Lands in Tennessee, Greenbrier, Oconaluftee in North Carolina, Forney Creek, Hazel Creek, Eagle Creek, and lots of other smaller communities scattered around the area. So there are about estimates of a little over 4,000 people living in what's now the park when it was created that were forced to sell their land to the government and move out.
So tell us about Hazel Creek. What intrigued you about it that you wanted to write about it?
Well, having a long-term interest in the Smokies, my dissertation was on the establishment of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and then done a book on moonshine in the Smokies, and written a number of articles. I served for a number of years, and I'm actually back on the board of the Great Smoky Mountains Association, which runs the bookstores in the park and contributes a couple $1 million a year to the park. So I've had a long, very fruitful connection to the Smokies, I guess, beginning when I first moved to this area from Lake Village, Arkansas in 1959, because back then there was no I-40 coming through. And so you most of the time you came Highway 441 right through the Smokies. And so that was one of my first remembrances. The one remembrance I have was that we stopped in Cherokee, and my parents bought me a little black bear, which I had for years and years until it pretty much fell apart. So from the earliest time that I've been in this area, I've had some connection with the park and spent a lot of time in there hiking and camping and fishing and things like that. So it's been a love. And so when the opportunity came up, and actually the Great Smoky Mountains Association invited me to write a book on Hazel Creek, I jumped at the opportunity, and then I started thinking about what I was getting myself into, because it is a place, Hazel Creek is a place that people feel very passionately about. And I knew that on a number of issues related to Hazel Creek, that no matter what I said, I was probably going to make someone mad. I decided to keep on with it, and I'm glad I did, because it's been a lot of fun.
That sort of lingering anger really comes to the Fontana Dam project?
Is that partly correct? But there are other issues as well, going back to some of the earliest days of Hazel Creek, particularly into the early 20th century, the kind of the legacy of Horace Kephart, who well-known Western North Carolina writer who actually came to the area about 1903 and stayed in Hazel Creek for about a little over a year, and then that formed the core of his book, Our Southern Highlanders. And so there's a lot of controversy around that. There's, of course, the controversy over the building of the dam and the and the condemnation through eminent domain of the people's property, them being forced to move. And then, of course, the big controversy over the years has been the so-called Road to Nowhere issue.
Tell us how that still colors, I think, a lot of the thoughts of the federal government in this region to this day. What happened with those things that you just listed?
Well, in particular, the road issue, the condemnation issue is one that still lingers in lots of places. And people don't, you know, some people, you know, do visit these places. And for one thing, the Park Service, up until recent years, had kind of interpreted the history of those places as, you know, isn't it wonderful that these people, you know, kind of voluntarily gave up their land so that we could have this great national park? And that's just not true, because these people were not happy at all about being removed. And so the people who own the land are all dead now, but there are people still alive who lived as children in these places who have very fond memories of the places, and then their descendants. And there are a lot, and there are still reunions in a lot of these places. And so a lot of the feelings about that have tempered over the years, but there's still some lingering resentment over that. The Park Service, I will say, in recent years has done a much better job of acknowledging the true sacrifice that these people made. Again, it wasn't voluntary for the most part that they made that sacrifice. The other thing that kind of fuels that resentment, particularly in around Hazel Creek and in Swain County, in particular, is the whole road issue, where when the dam was, the Fontana Dam was built, the people were removed because the road leading into the community was flooded and they were essentially cut off. And in 1943, the Park Service and TVA and the state of North Carolina and Swain County signed an agreement saying that they would replace the road. And so that has dragged out for, well, I'm not too good in math, for how many years? 70-something years now. And there is no road, and although a settlement has been made, only a small portion of that settlement has been paid by the federal government. So there's a good bit of distrust, obviously, and again, represented on the edge, they actually built part of the road, which really strangely, if you drive up from Bryson City by the Swain County High School, and in the road abruptly, you go about 6 miles inside the park, and then the road abruptly ends at this very long tunnel. That's the road is blocked before you get to the tunnel, but you can walk through the tunnel, and so it's really strange. Right at the park boundary is a sign that has been there. I'm not sure how many years it's been there, but which is redone every year, that says, you know, however many years of broken promises, 1943 to ? And in broken promises in large letters, or actually it says the road to nowhere, and then however many years of broken promises, 1943 to ? Which is still there, freshly painted every year. And a reminder, something very vivid in the minds of people in Swain County.
What was Hazel Creek like, and what did you learn about it as you wrote the book?
Well, one thing, you know, part of the, I guess, controversy when you go back to Kephart, because Kephart characterized Hazel Creek in our Southern Highlanders as a place that was essentially locked in the 18th century. In fact, he uses the term that these people were essentially living as Daniel Boone did, and which was not at all true, actually, when he came there, because Hazel Creek had been settled, very few families. The first family came in about 1830. I figured out in the book that was another thing I thought might spark some controversy, but no one said anything about it. But Moses Proctor was the first settler. He actually came over from Tennessee, from Cades Cove. And he was a squatter for a long time because a friend of mine actually found when he first registered his deed and claim to the land, which was in the 1850s. And so he was a good number of years as a squatter. So you had a few people filtering in, you know, not many families there before the Civil War. A few more came in afterwards. And then in the 1890s, the community started to grow more because you had the first industrial logging that came into the area. And then a couple of copper mines. People don't realize that there are copper deposits in the Smokies as part of a chain that really starts in lower East Tennessee around the Ducktown area and extends into the Smokies. But pretty profitable copper mines there. Right before Kephart came to the area, the tambourine and the copper mines shut down. And so here is a community that actually had been a part of the Industrial Revolution. People were getting wages. They were buying stuff in stores, this type of thing. But then they had kind of been thrown back at that point. They'd either left the community or had been thrown back on eking out a living, trying to farm very marginal land in there. And so the community was pretty poor. There were a lot of people in the community at that time because of the poverty of the area that were supplementing their income by making moonshine. And so Kephart, I don't know if he didn't realize what had happened or didn't want to, but he really characterized, again, these people as having been there for a long time, which most of them hadn't been. And is being untouched by the modern world. Well, they were very much products of the modern world because they were in the middle of a bust, of an industrial bust in the area. So Kephart was there for a short period of time. And again, that image kind of stuck at Hazel Creek. But Hazel Creek was like, you know, again, Kephart called it the back of beyond. And it was and is one of the hardest places to get to around. But even Hazel Creek, this very isolated place, was very much shaped by the Industrial Revolution. And so after Kephart moves out, the Ritter Lumber Company comes in, and Hazel Creek almost overnight, and again, it had a boom period in the late 1890s, but it really boomed at that point. And so you had a town that just grew up overnight practically around 1910 or so, the town of Proctor, which at one point at its peak had probably close to 1,000 people. And there are other fairly sizable communities on up the creek. And actually they built a railroad up the creek that went almost to the state line divide and a huge lumber mill there with all, you know, drying kilns and all kinds of state-of-the-art type of equipment. So it really kind of goes against that image of this isolated community because you could walk right into Proctor, jump on a train, and within a couple of days you could be in New York City. And so this was a real boom time when Ritter Lumber Company was there. And a lot of the people who have roots in Hazel Creek, that this was the time period when they had family members there, you know, because there were so many people in there because this was a huge hardwood timber. The Ritter was, you know, called the king of the hardwood lumberman, and he and had operations all over the southern Appalachian region, but this is one of their largest. And so, again, you know, you had railroads, you had all these, you know, you had a movie theater, you had all these things going on in Proctor, and it was just a bustling community at that point. Well, the practice then was, as they call, cut and run. And so by the mid-1920s, they had cut out the watershed pretty much of all the valuable hardwood timber, and they took off and went to other places to exploit the timber there, pulled up the tracks. And then Hazel Creek kind of has another bust period. And actually most of the people left. Most of the land was sold to an Asheville real estate developer who created an elite hunting and fishing club there that attracted really all kinds of elite business people. Branch Rickey, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who's most famous for desegregating baseball by bringing in Jackie Robinson, came annually to Hazel Creek to hunt bear. And And people came to fish, and this is when Hazel Creek became the story of Hazel Creek became one as this kind of hunting and fishing preserve at that time. And so you had a few people, and then you have another period of bust in the early 1940s when TVA comes in and builds a dam there, which is the Fontana Dam, the tallest dam east of the Rockies, and to provide electricity during World War II to the Alcoa aluminum plant over the mountains in Tennessee. And what people didn't know, there were also a little crossroads community in Tennessee that was rapidly being transformed, the community of Oak Ridge, which had massive electricity needs. People did not know why, but of course they were developing the atomic bomb there. And so Fontana was very crucial. I love there was a sign there at Fontana to kind of encourage the workers, you know, to work harder. And it said we are building this dam to generate the electricity to make the aluminum, to make the bombers, to bomb the bastards. And so it was just, but it was incredible. And again, thousands of people came into the area to build this dam, which was amazing. They built the dam in about 3 years' time. But of course, then that meant that the people were going to have to leave. So to me, the story of this community is not of this static, isolated community. It's the story of a place that is being transformed rapidly, particularly once you get into the 1890s, by the forces of the Industrial Revolution in the modern world. So in that sense, I disagree with Kephart and think, you know, Hazel Creek is a very modern place in many ways.
Fast forwarding to 2018, the Great Smoky Mountain National Park and the Blue Ridge Parkway are the two most visited in the park system. What is it about this area, this region, the Appalachian Mountains in particular, since both of those touch that range, what is it that draws people here? What is so, I guess, fascinating to people who aren't from here about the things that they see in these parks and in this region?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors that get, I mean, for one, you know, I think, you know, when you look at the parkway and then you look at Highway 441 and then the spur road that goes up to Clingman's Dome, is that feeling of being away from things and then the spectacular views that you have. And so, I mean, one of the things when they were first talking about making the Smokies, there were no parks except for Acadia, which is pretty small and actually had been purchased the land had been donated by several millionaires, including the Rockefeller family. But that was the only park in the East. And so they hadn't really taken on the whole thing. The federal government would not buy land. And so they said if the states would buy the land, and then they could turn it over to the federal government. So they had to do a big advertising and media campaign, public relations campaign to sell a park. And one of the things they had to sell to the country was that that these places had the scenic values that were commensurate to the Western parks. And I think the more people saw, you know, they saw, okay, it's got the views. The mountains are not as sharp. They're covered in, you know, it's much greener. But again, the value, of course, the peak time of the year for both the Parkway and for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park are fall. And so those fall colors, you know, are kind of an additional attraction that you don't quite get. You get the aspens and some of that stuff out west, but not quite the same. So this is something unique. And then another thing that was important at that time and is the fact that the Smokies had some of the last vestiges of old growth forest in the eastern United States. There wasn't much left that hadn't been logged, but they had some of the last vestiges of those places, and that's really one of my favorite things is to get into some of these old growth areas, and you have to hike a ways to get to them. But that is there's something about it, and I think people who are, you know, most visitors to the Smokies, you know, drive Highway 441 or or people drive the parkway, you know, and they stop at the overlooks and they look over and they ooh and ah and stuff like that, you know, and don't get very far from their cars. But, you know, more and more people are getting on the trails and seeing what is really neat. And one of the things that I love is those old growth forests. And again, that feeling of that was attractive to, you know, people like Horace Kephart, you know, that feeling of solitude, of being away from civilization. And that's one of the things I love about the views themselves, you know, is to be able, even like in the evening, to look out over those mountains and not see any lights and not see any evidences of human beings. And I think there's something there that attracts people is nice. And then you got the added attraction with the Smokies and with the parkway, you know, is that they're not that far away from civilization. So you can go up and you can look out and you can see this wonderful sight and look out over wilderness, and then you can drive down the mountain to Gatlinburg or Pigeon Forge or the other way, and you can drive down to Cherokee and go to Harris Casino, you know. So that is part of the attraction, though, I think, that you have this national park in an area that's accessible to a large part of the American population. And I'm always, I don't know why I'm surprised, because this is the original vision of the people that were promoting the park. They liked the natural aspects of the park, but the reason they pushed so hard for it was because they wanted it as a tourist attraction. They wanted to bring in, one of my favorite quotes was from a Knoxville auto dealer who said, you know, if we build this park, these tourists will come in and they will scatter their golden shekels in our midst. And it's true. It's happened. I mean, you look, you know, you drive into the park and then you see these tags from all over. I mean, tons of Ohio people. I've been amazed, you know, the people that I've gotten to know over the years, you know, who have reached out to me from Ohio, you know, who really love the park and come down here free, or from Mississippi, or, you know, all over the place, you know, that people have this attraction. So, again, that's part of the values. You got this incredible, large natural area, but it's relatively close. The attraction of Hazel Creek is a little different because there's no road, in, obviously, in Hazel Creek. And so you really got to want to go there. And so you either got to hike about 12 miles or so, or take a boat across the lake, and you can pay to take a shuttle. Or what I do is usually borrow my brother's, or well, I recruit my brother to go with me, and we take his canoes and go across the lake, which is a lot of fun. And in fact, I well remember, and I wrote about this in the book, the day, one of the things I started doing from the very beginning, when I get to the end of a book and I'm writing conclusion, I always go to that, to the place that I'm writing about, and just kind of experience it. And so we made a trip to Hazel Creek right before, and with my brother and with my colleague Evan Gurney, and we went up and fished right across the lake, and then we came back across the lake late in the afternoon. It was one of the most beautiful sights I've ever experienced. And so that's the attraction of Hazel Creek, I think. Although one of the weird things about Hazel Creek is that the trail is pretty level for the first 5 miles or so that it runs across along Hazel Creek. And so you have these really weird things. They call them, they're different names for them, Hazel Creek buggies or Hazel Creek Cadillacs. And these things that people build, they're kind of like I don't know how to describe them, you know, but they're, you know, they use bicycle wheels. They're kind of like big wheelbarrow kind of things, but made of real lightweight material. And you can haul a bunch of stuff in there, you know, so you can take coolers, you know, with steaks and cases of beer and stuff like that, you know, which can be problematic in a place like that. So for most people, though, it's the solitude, it's the fishing, it's that being in touch with, you know, again, being in a place, you know, where you're really away from everything.
I guess my last question would be, what's the lesson that we can learn from the history of how the park was created that you've looked at in Hazel Creek? And again, I say this because something you mentioned, this isn't that far removed from our history. It's only a few generations back. So what are the lessons of history of the creations of the Great Smoky National Park that we need to learn?
Yeah, being in our current historical moment, I think our default position as Americans maybe is that everything's going to hell, and we are doomed. You know, global warming's going to overwhelm us, and these are serious issues, and I don't want to belittle any of that. You know, our political situation is totally dysfunctional. We are so polarized as a nation, you know, that we can't carry on civil conversation. And I think our tendency, we have become so negative that we forget the really positive things in our history. And again, Hazel Creek and the Smokies are a complicated thing because there are negatives there. There's no question about it. You know, that, you know, this whole issue of removal is one. The road issue, you know, is an important issue. And you know, I never thought the road was a good idea, but it's a broken promise, you know, that the federal government needs to honor. But to me, you know, that issue, those words, and it really came to me when I was writing the conclusion, those words, broken promise, you know, is what people remember. What jumped out at me was that Hazel Creek and the park in general are an example of a promise kept by the federal government, which we all like to trash in one way or another. But it is an example because the Organic Act that created the National Park Service said that the mission of the Park Service was to preserve these very special places, as it, the language says, unimpaired for future generations. And that's hard to do. And there are all sorts of complicating factors there because, you know, you can't just leave something unimpaired, but, you know, as much as possible, I guess you would say. And so I think, and particularly when you look at the Smokies and what they were like, and they do have these islands of old growth, but for the most part, this was an area that was devastated by industrial logging. If you look at the pictures, and if you see the pictures, the devastating forest fires that came, the mudslides and everything else that were left over from that area, you see a devastated landscape. When you look today, you know, up from Newfound Gap or off Clingman's Dome or Charlie's Bunyan or somewhere like that, you look down on all these trees, and of course we do have dead hemlocks because of an invasive species. It's not a perfect example, but the thing that I see is redemption. You know, as here was a scarred landscape, but through the efforts of people who weren't necessarily environmentalists, but people who sacrificed a lot, and those people who unwillingly gave up their land, we have a place that is, you know, a treasure not only to people in this region, but to the country and to the world. I mean, people come from all over the world to the Smokies and treasure that. I mean, lots of Germans when you go into the Smokies. So I look at it that way as an example of the possibilities for good. And I think we have to keep in mind, because we get so negative, that we don't believe in any solutions. And I think it's just a great story about the possibilities of what people can do, you know, when they want to cooperate and act together and create something really magnificent.
Dan Pierce, thank you so much for coming in. This has been really illuminating, and just it's fascinating to hear these stories of these areas that are so close to us, but the history of it is not that far removed from 2018. It's just very interesting, and thank you so much for coming to tell it to us.
Thank you, Matt. And just one more plug is that, you know, with this wonderful gift, there come responsibilities to the present generation to maintain it for future generations. And so I just encourage people to look up some of the cooperating associations that are benefiting the Smokies and the Blue Ridge Parkway. These public lands, you know, don't protect themselves. And so we all need to take an interest in that.